time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello and welcome. Halloween is officially over, and to me, that means it's Christmas. I just love the holiday season, and I know there's Thanksgiving in there for my US listeners, and I love the food, but I just need to see a Christmas tree. Nothing combats seasonal depression for me like twinkly lights, and that's important, and I think that's called self-care. I know some people don't really like seeing holiday stuff this early, but that will literally never be me. Some people like going on runs to make their brain happy, but my brain needs some warm-scented candles, some twinkly lights, and some hot cocoa in a gingerbread mug. And that doesn't make me a bad person. But you know what else is self-care? Going over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast and listening to a bunch of bonus episodes. The story we're going to be talking about this month is the story of Ben Gowans, Jason Cox, and Clay Craig, who took a trip into the Grand Canyon, but their adventure became a nightmare when one of them suffered brain damage from a tragic fall. We also have 32 other full-length episodes that our patrons vote on, and we've talked about some really interesting stuff over there, so go check it out. But shameless self-plug over. Today, we're going to be talking about the frightening crime spree of a man who was supposed to be protecting people. And these are some of the scariest cases to me, when someone in power, in this case a security guard, abuses that power and does some really terrible things. But with nothing else to say at the top, why don't we just jump in? Kaylee Ann Sawyer was born to Julie Van Cleve and Jamie Sawyers on March 2nd, 1993. Her parents divorced when she was just a child, and both of them went on to remarry, but Kaylee was close to both of her parents and her stepparents. Her mother married a man named Chris, and her dad, Jamie, married a woman named Crystal. She had lived in Bend, Oregon, her whole life, and was the eldest child of five siblings in her blended family. And when Kaylee was little, she had trouble saying her name, so she referred to herself as KK Foyer. The nickname KK stuck, and that's what her family called her as she grew up and on. She was a sweet, bubbly, beautiful girl and was overall a bright light of a person. She loved reading. One of her favorites was Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss. And Kaylee had many friends in high school. She was on the cheer team and she loved to live her life to the fullest at all times. She was also an enrolled member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, South Dakota, since she was the great-great-great-granddaughter of Chief Joseph Forebear. In 2016, Kaylee was 23 years old and was working as a dental assistant at Aubrey Dental Group. She had enrolled at Central Oregon Community College and was studying to become a dentist herself in the future. At the time, she was living with her boyfriend of 2 years, Cameron Riemhofer. The two seemed like they were very in love. Kaylee's family really liked Cameron, and it seemed like they might be endgame. They had a bright future ahead of them and had talked about getting engaged and married in the future. Kaylee and Cameron's apartment was really nice. It was close to campus and was in a safe neighborhood and was often patrolled by security officers, so the two felt safe there. On July 23rd, 2016, Kaylee was going to her friend Lisa's bachelorette party in downtown Bend. Kaylee initially wasn't going to go and told people that she was going to be out of town, but at the last minute, Kaylee changed her mind and decided that she would go. She dressed up in a black dress with brown boots with a green purse and met her friends at a country western bar called Mavericks just after 8 p.m. and she was having a great time with her friends that night. But after a while, things started winding down, and some of Kaylee's friends decided they were going to head out a little bit early, around 10:30 p.m. But Kaylee was still having fun, and was a little bit tipsy, and didn't really want to go home yet. So she and another friend decided that they were going to continue to party, so they went to another bar downtown. They had a few more drinks, they were having fun, and Kaylee started dancing with a guy that she had just met. Her friend saw her doing that and texted Cameron to let him know what was going on. So shortly after midnight, Cameron went to the bar to pick Kaylee up. And how this exactly happened is a little bit unclear because some sources say that he showed up just after that text message from the friend, but others say that Kaylee called him to come and get her. Either way, Cameron came to the bar and picked her up. And on the way home, the two had an argument, most likely about what had gone down at the bar. And when they returned to their apartment complex, Cameron parked the car, and Kaylee, who was still upset from the argument, decided to stay in the car to cool down. So Cameron went up to their apartment to give her some space. About 10 minutes or so later, Cameron came back downstairs to check on Kaylee, but when he got to his car, she wasn't there. She had decided to go on a walk to let out some steam and gather her thoughts. And this wasn't an unusual thing for Kaylee to do when she was upset, but sadly for her, and for women in general, going on a walk alone at night isn't always the safest thing to do. And that's not Kaylee's fault, that's just the messed up world that we live in. But to her, she had gone on walks like that countless times before when she was upset, and she also lived in what she believed to be a safe neighborhood. But to make matters worse, she was still a little bit drunk.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Cameron tried texting Kaylee around 12:30 saying, "Where are you? Please come home and talk to me at least. You're being unfair." Kaylee responded, "Are you kidding? What a joke. I'm sorry I'm not good enough for you." Cameron replied, "I don't get how you can say that." Kaylee responded, "If you wanted me, you could have, but you don't care. If you cared even a little bit, you'd know where I am. Sorry I'm not as important as your phone." Cameron then responded, "Kaylee, please just come home to be with me. I don't want to play this game. I'll start searching, but please help me out." Kaylee then told Cameron that her phone was about to die. And Cameron told her he'd driven slowly up and down College Way, but he didn't see her. Kaylee then sent her last text at 1 a.m. that said, "Are you kidding? Because that's bullshit. Goodbye. Phone off." And Cameron responded, "Kaylee, please." Now, even though these last messages were pretty heated, I don't think that necessarily defined their relationship, because by all accounts, they were good together. But alcohol, of course, never helps things, and Kaylee was dancing with another man, which I'm sure hurt Cameron's feelings. But also keep in mind, both Kaylee and Cameron were still in their early 20s, and most relationships at that age don't work out anyway. But the day prior, Kaylee's father had texted her saying that he hadn't heard from her in a while, and asked if everything was okay. And Kaylee responded that she was sorry, but she had been busy trying to figure things out. So it does seem like they were going through a bit of a rough patch. And that sucks. But when Cameron didn't find Kaylee that night, he had to assume that she was taking the night to cool off. So he reluctantly headed home and hoped that he would hear from her in the morning, but sadly, he would never hear from her again. The next morning when Cameron woke up and Kaylee wasn't in bed with him, he looked around their apartment, but no luck. He tried to call Kaylee at 9 a.m., but it went to voicemail. He called her friends and even went to a few of their houses, hoping she had gone there to spend the night. Kaylee's car, a Subaru Impreza, was parked where she had left it the day before, but Kaylee wasn't there either. At this time, Cameron didn't really think anything too crazy had happened. He just figured Kaylee hadn't come home yet and was still mad about their fight last night. But when hours went by, with still no sign of her, he decided it was time to call Kaylee's parents. It was a Sunday, and Kaylee's father, Jamie, was in church when he got the call. He did pick up, though, and then told his wife that Cam couldn't find Kaylee. Nobody had seen her since the following night at the bar, and her phone kept going to voicemail, even to her mother, Julie, who was away on a trip, but couldn't get a hold of her, which was very unusual. Kaylee not being in contact with anyone was very concerning, especially her parents. He even went to Kaylee's grandmother's house and her mother's home, even though Julie wasn't there at the time. So with no idea where Kaylee was, and with too much time going by, Cameron felt like it was time to call 911. He told them exactly what had happened, that they had had a fight, Kaylee walked off to calm down, and he hadn't seen her since. The 911 operator asked if she had any history of mental illness or physical health issues, and Cameron told them no. However, later, Kaylee's mother Julie told authorities that Kaylee had a history of epilepsy. She wanted the police to treat Kaylee's case with urgency, rather than wait a day or two to see if she would just turn up on her own. And if they think that there's a medical condition, it's taken more seriously, especially if that person has to take medication at a certain time. And honestly, I think this was a really smart call. Kaylee was 23, so in cases where there's a missing adult, sometimes police will wait because adults technically do have the right to leave without telling one, and they can kind of just disappear out of nowhere. So there have definitely been cases where adults have gone missing and police waited really long to start looking into it because of that fact. So I completely don't blame Julie for doing that. And Kaylee had had a seizure once before, many years earlier, and the condition was well managed, but Julie later said that she had no issue exaggerating her daughter's medical history because she wanted her daughter found, and she knew they needed to be urgent about it because this was not like her at all. And the first 48 hours are the most critical when locating a missing person, and Julie had a really terrible feeling that something sinister had happened. By that time, friends and community members had already made a missing persons poster and were out looking for Kaylee. Kaylee's parents had been driving around for hours looking for her and had gone to campus and to her apartment to look for her once again, with no luck. And because Cameron was her boyfriend, and the boyfriend is usually to blame for situations like this, the police definitely questioned him. Cameron was also the last person to see Kaylee before she went missing, and they had a fight. But thankfully for him, he was soon ruled out as a suspect. He had been extremely cooperative with the police and was genuinely concerned. He let them look at his phone, his computer, his car, literally anything they needed, and officers believed that Cam truly had no idea where Kaylee was. Some of Kaylee's friends were also interviewed and were quickly ruled out, but next up was the man that Kaylee had danced with at the bar the night before. They thought it was possible Kaylee had gone to meet up with him after her fight with Cameron, and that man admitted to flirting with Kaylee, but he insisted he hadn't seen her after she left the bar. He didn't even get her number. Their interaction was very casual and was strictly at the bar. So, with no leads and no firm suspects, the police were stumped. It was possible Kaylee had left on her own and was taking a few days to figure things out like she had told her father, but when she didn't show up to work the following day, that's when things were looking really bad. Kaylee was a very good employee, and her job was super important to her, so when she didn't show up, it seemed pretty clear that she was in trouble. Investigators were desperately looking for clues, which was when they found that there was actually activity under Kaylee's Apple ID, which seemed like a promising lead, but it was discovered that it was from one of Kaylee's friends who had been using an old iPhone of Kaylee's. The Apple ID just hadn't been removed from the account. And I'm sure that was a tough blow because you think there's still some hope, she's using her phone, she has to be alive, but it was just a friend using an old phone, which really sucks. But that same morning, Monday, July 25th, something extremely unexpected happened. A woman named Isabel Ponce Lara, who was a rookie cop, had approached police with some shocking information and was specifically requesting to speak to a supervisor. Isabel had just spent a normal weekend with her husband, Edwin Lara. He had moved to the U.S. at 11 years old from Honduras and had gotten an associate's degree in criminal justice and was now 31 years old and was a security guard for Central Oregon Community College. He had gotten home in the early hours of Sunday morning after working his night shift as a campus security officer, but by around 7:30 a.m., Edwin was back home and in bed with Isabel by the time she had woken up. They went to church together that morning, as they normally would, because Edwin was very devout. He studied the Bible, and he never missed church unless he absolutely had to. But Edwin seemed kind of quiet that morning, and he was less affectionate than he normally would have been. Usually he would rub her head and show her affection throughout the church service, but he hadn't done any of that. So after church, Isabel asked him what was wrong, but he didn't really explain. She figured it was just normal stress from work, so she didn't really press him on it. The only thing out of the ordinary, other than Edwin acting weird, was that he had his windows on his car cracked open, which he never did. He told her it had been hot, so he had to crack the windows, which was explanation enough for Isabel. The two then got some Pizza Hut and went home to watch Netflix together, but later he suggested they go out to see a movie instead. They went to go see a horror movie with Edwin's cousin called Lights Out. And after the movie, the couple went home, took a shower, got intimate with each other, and then went to bed. The next morning was July 25th, and Edwin got out of bed and went to the living room where Isabel was watching TV. Isabel noticed his eyes were very teary, so she turned off the TV and asked him what was going on. He described a horrific accident he had been in. He claimed that he accidentally hit a woman with the campus security car, and after that he had panicked and hid her body. Isabel was alarmed and confused. She wanted to believe her husband, but she didn't understand why somebody would hide a body if it was only an accident. She tried to get more information out of him, but he wouldn't say anything else as he paced around the room. After he had confessed to his wife, Edwin took her gun and drove off, leaving her to worry that he might do something to hurt himself. Can you actually imagine? You have a completely normal evening, you wake up, you're watching TV, you're sitting on your couch, it's a typical morning. And then your husband approaches you with tears coming down his face and tells you he hit a woman with his car and hid her body? In that split second where she's processing what he's about to drop on her, I would never think that my partner was going to say that. Also, they had a completely normal evening together, and now he's grabbing her gun and running out the door? Like, how do you even begin to wrap your head around that? So Isabel didn't really. She didn't know what to do. And right before he left, he had told her that the woman's things were in their shed. So after he left, Isabel, who was reeling, went to their shed and saw everything, which was when she decided it was definitely time to go to the police. So at 11:52 a.m. on Monday, July 25th, she arrived at the police station. Isabel was visibly very upset and shaken, and it was clear that she had nothing to do with what had happened to this woman that Edwin had hit. This was all very shocking information. The story itself was disturbing, but also this man was a security officer whose job it was to help keep people safe. He had a degree in criminal justice, and he was married to a cop. Following the information about Edwin's quote-unquote accident, and then hiding the body, the police were quickly able to put the pieces together. They had this missing girl, and now they had this confession from a man who said he hit a girl and then hid her body. So police immediately put out the information for officers to look for Edwin's car, and they got a search warrant for Isabel and Edwin's home. And inside Edwin's shed, they found a trash bag full of a woman's belongings, just as he had told Isabel. Inside the bag, they found high heels, a green purse that had been soaked in blood, and inside of that, they found the ID card of Kaylee Sawyer. They also found another plastic bag with bloody clumps of blonde hair and a rock that was also stained with blood. They already doubted this whole accident claim, but now it seemed really clear that this was way more sinister than he was letting on. The police said, quote, "Some people leave the scene of accidents because they're scared, but they return a short time later," or something like that, but that's not what Ed did. The red-stained rock was taken into evidence as a potential murder weapon, and they found Edwin's uniform that was also soaked in blood. So the disappearance of Kaylee Sawyer had quickly turned into a murder investigation. Like I said earlier, Edwin had studied criminal justice, and propped up against the wall of his shed was a college psychology project. It was a graphic informational poster board about the Railroad Killer. The Railroad Killer was an active serial killer in the 1990s. He was a drifter hopping from freight train to freight train to avoid being caught as he murdered at least 15 people across the U.S. and Mexico. And Edwin's poster was smeared with red paint to mimic blood spatter and handprints, along with graphic images of the victims' bodies. The Railroad Killer's weapon of choice was whatever was closest to him at the time, including the use of heavy rocks. It was a really disturbing parallel between his poster board and what they now believed was Kaylee Sawyer's murder weapon. It was also kind of a look into the twisted mind and interests of her potential murderer. Police immediately approached Kaylee's family and let them know that this investigation had turned into a homicide investigation. Kaylee's parents were absolutely heartbroken. There was a search party that was organized to look for Kaylee the following morning, but her parents weren't allowed to tell anyone that the case had been changed to a homicide investigation. And instead of looking for a living Kaylee, they were actually looking for her body. I cannot imagine the pain that they had to deal with and how difficult it must have been to conceal that. It is just truly heartbreaking and a nightmare. And meanwhile, Edwin was still missing.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Police returned to Isabel to ask her more questions about her husband's character. They asked if he was a drinker, if he had ever been violent, or if he had anger issues, and she told them that she and her husband had stopped drinking when they started going back to church, and that Edwin had never been violent with her, but he had been having an affair. He had family back in California and had been seeing a woman there while Isabel was in the police academy. But according to her, they had been working through their issues after Edwin begged her for forgiveness. However, Edwin's coworkers painted a bit of a different story. According to them, Edwin had showed them nude photos of his mistress and of himself and reportedly had a fascination with dead bodies. Edwin made one of his female colleagues so uncomfortable that she refused to ride alone in a car with him. That's a pretty intense description of someone. Oh yeah, he showed me the naked photos of him and a woman he's having an affair with, and I'm so terrified of him because of his fascination with dead bodies that I won't get in a car with him? He's that creepy? Like, whoa. And right after finding out about this affair, Isabel went on several ride-alongs with Edwin to keep him within arm's reach. He showed her places around campus that were out of the way and hidden from public view. And according to her, he knew the back roads of this area very well. By that point, police knew they were looking for Kaylee's body. And with the new information they had been given, it was clear that Edwin could have buried her anywhere. But even more urgent than that was finding him. But they had no idea where he could have gone. So where Edwin had gone was to his parents' house and had switched out his car for theirs because he was officially on the run and wanted to evade capture for as long as possible. And unfortunately for everyone, Edwin wasn't done. He would continue to commit crimes across two states. And that brings us to 19-year-old Andrea Mays, who was working at a Ross Dress for Less at the time in Salem, Oregon, which was a town only a few hours northeast of Bend. At 8:45 p.m., after a 12-hour shift, she got into her car and relaxed for a moment on her phone looking at social media. She posted a selfie on Snapchat and read a Facebook message from a friend when Edwin Lara decided she would be his next victim. Edwin had been armed with his wife's gun, was wearing a backpack and a bulletproof vest when he approached her car. He shoved his arm through the cracked open window of Andrea's car, unlocked her door, and demanded that she take him where he wanted to go, at gunpoint. And fearing for her life, she had no choice but to do what he said. And this situation is extremely scary because this poor girl just worked a 12-hour shift and she is just unwinding in her car for 5 minutes before she drives home. She wanted to post a selfie on Snapchat and look at her social media for 2 seconds. And even that is too unsafe to do sometimes. And that just really sucks because as a woman, it feels like you're not safe anywhere unless you're home behind a locked door. You can't go on a walk at night alone. You can't sit in your car in the parking lot for too long because there's creeps who are going to do crazy things like this man. So Edwin gets into Andrea's car, but her car was on empty, so the two had to stop for gas. And he warned her as they pulled into the gas station that if she made eye contact with anyone, He would shoot them and her, and it would be her fault. She begged him to just take her car, but he didn't want to do that. He wanted her as well. So after driving for about an hour, Edwin started to get really freaked out and told Andrea to pull over since she had been driving too fast. So he handcuffed her to the gear shift. That way she couldn't escape as he drove himself. That way they wouldn't be stopped for speeding. And while they drove, he told her he had been waiting in that parking lot for a while, waiting for a woman that he could carjack. He said he even spoke to a pregnant woman, but she brushed him off and I guess got away, which is badass. But Edwin boasted to Andrea, "Little did that woman know what I could have done to her." Edwin also claimed to be a cop, but then said, "I don't know if you've heard what happened to the girl I just killed." He even showed her news reports about Kaylee. He asked her personal questions about herself, but she refused to tell him anything, knowing that he could potentially harm her family members. And they continued like that for several hours until they reached a motel in southern Oregon around 11:40 p.m. As the two checked into a room, Andrea and Edwin were caught on CCTV footage as he made her pretend to be his girlfriend. She stood there next to him with her arms crossed, looking very uncomfortable. But he told her that if she didn't pretend to act completely normal, he'd kill her and the motel clerk. She did begin crying at one point, but the motel clerk hadn't noticed and allowed them to check in without issue. Once in the hotel room, Edwin took a shower as Andrea was handcuffed to the bathroom door with a shirt over her head. He then tried to get her to take a shower, but she refused. He then handcuffed Andrea to the bed frame and forced sleeping pills down her throat. He then started making really terrifying advances toward her. He even licked her earlobe and asked her if she was a virgin, which is absolutely disgusting. She was trying with everything in her to stay awake because she was so terrified that if she fell asleep, he would assault her. But suddenly, her phone alarm went off, and Edwin got very startled and freaked out because he believed someone was trying to figure out where she was. But Andrea thought very quickly and told Edwin that she had a very harmful STI, and her alarm went off as a reminder to take her medication. He questioned her about this STI, but with each question, she just made it sound more and more awful in an effort to keep him away from her. And after that, Edwin didn't touch her. But he did become increasingly anxious about helicopters being sent to find him. And can we just take a moment for the gigantic brain inside Andrea's head? Also, how lucky is she that her phone alarm went off? That is such a terrifying situation. And I think she deserves all the props in the world for thinking that quickly on her feet and getting his creepy ass away from her. So after he's anxiously looking out the window, searching for helicopters, they left the motel. And as they left, he used Andrea as a human shield as they got into the car around 1:30 a.m. As they drove, Andrea's car was leaking oil, so Edwin decided they needed to steal a new one. And the two made it all the way to Yreka, California at 5 a.m., where they pulled off into a Super 8 motel parking lot where they found a wildlife photographer named Jack Levy who was loading up his car. Jack Levy was in the area to take pictures of butterflies. I mean, can you imagine anything more wholesome than that? You're literally in the area to take pictures of butterflies and then someone carjacks you? Awful. But Edwin had decided that Jack was his next victim, so with Andrea by his side, he busted into Jack's room, demanding his car keys. But Jack responded in a way that Edwin wasn't expecting. He refused to hand over his keys and instead began screaming for help. And desperate to avoid attention, and with nothing left to lose, Edwin unfortunately shot Jack Levy in the abdomen. As Jack lay there bleeding, Edwin dragged Andrea on foot to a nearby gas station. Edwin was still in need of a new car because they didn't get Jack's car keys, and they decided that a family who was parked in the gas station was the perfect next target. An unsuspecting couple, their son, and two grandkids were on a road trip heading back to LA and were stopped at a gas station to use the restroom before getting back on the road. The grandfather and son were in the gas station, but the grandmother and her two grandsons were in the car as they waited. 17-year-old Nima Gavimi and his grandmother and younger brother were in their car, but all of a sudden Edwin shoved Andrea into the car and pointed a gun at Nima, who was in the driver's seat, and demanded he drive or Edwin would shoot. This was really going off the rails because now not only did he have Andrea, but he kidnapped a 17-year-old, the younger brother, and their grandmother. Nima did as he was told, terrified that this man might shoot his family members. And as they drove, Edwin made some bizarre conversation. He asked them if they had ever had the urge to kill. He blamed his own urge for what he had done. He told them he had killed Kaylee and had just shot a guy at a Super 8 motel. Meanwhile, Nima's grandmother was in the backseat screaming in her native language of Farsi, but Edwin told Nima to make her shut up or he'd shoot. He then took her phone to make sure she didn't call 911. And about 15 minutes later, when they couldn't get her to calm down, he had Nima pull over and had the terrified family get out of their car, but continued on with Andrea. He wouldn't let her go because he needed her to keep the police from shooting him. His behavior had become increasingly erratic, and it was at this time that he decided that he'd give up any hope that he would get out of these crimes, so he took Andrea's phone and started recording a video bragging about his crimes to post on Facebook. He said, "Hi everybody, I just want to say that I apologize for everything I've done. Most likely I'm going to get caught. Sorry about that girl in Central Oregon." He then said he wanted to let Andrea's family members know she's fine and she will be fine, and so far she's been doing everything he's told her to do. He then said, "And if you're wondering if I've done dirty things to her, no, I'm not that kind of guy." He said sorry to her family members and her grandmother and her boyfriend, but she'd be home soon. He also said, "Tell the cops not to shoot us, because if they shoot us, then it's not my fault." What a weird man. Also, "You're not that kind of guy? Okay, first of all, yes you are. Second of all, what do you want, a gold star? Like, what a freak." So after taking that video, he told Andrea to post it on her Facebook profile with the caption, "Murderer on the Loose." And since she was embarrassed about the whole terrifying situation and didn't want any of her Facebook friends to see this video, she managed to change the privacy settings on her post to make it so the video posted, but only she would be able to see it. And that just breaks my heart as well, because she had nothing to feel embarrassed about. Nothing about that situation was a reflection of her. She was kidnapped by a crazy man. But again, she used her quick thinking and posted it so only she could see it. At some point, they changed drivers again, and Edwin was behind the wheel. Around that time, Edwin had also called his wife Isabel, and the two spoke in Spanish, so Andrea couldn't fully understand what they were saying, but she said it sounded like Isabel was trying to convince him to turn himself in. And during that call, police had been able to get a cell phone ping on Interstate 5 freeway near Redding, California, which was when the chase started. So police were already on his tail. And after that phone conversation with his wife, around 6:40 a.m., Edwin did call 911 to turn himself in. The operator tried to convince him to stop the car immediately. The police already had a chopper following behind him down Interstate 5. Edwin told the dispatcher that he wouldn't stop the car right then, but he would turn himself in Corning. But he told her that he had asthma, so he didn't want them to be too rough on him. And he said he would need an inhaler because he forgot his at home. And I couldn't believe that, because the fact that his main concern was someone having an inhaler for him is absolutely crazy. He had just killed a 23-year-old girl, kidnapped a 19-year-old, shot a man, and kidnapped a family. And he's like, can you have an inhaler for me when you arrest me? Unbelievable. The dispatcher asked how fast he was going, and he told them about 120 miles per hour. They asked him if he could slow down, but he told them he wanted to get to Corning fast so he could turn himself in. But the dispatcher asked him, "Why can't you just slow down and come to a stop? Why did you need to go to Corning? What's the difference between right here and Corning?" And he told her that he didn't want to put himself or anyone else in danger. Pulling off on the side of the highway would be pretty dangerous. Which again is ridiculous, but still, they were trying to get him to stop, but he told them he had to call all of his family, and then once he did that, he would turn himself in. But he also used Andrea and his knowledge of where Kaylee Sawyer's body was as leverage for the police not to shoot him. He admitted on the 911 call that he did kill Kaylee Sawyer, and he knew where her body was, and he would tell them where it was in time. He claimed that her death was an accident, that he had hit her with his car because she was too drunk, and then because she was screaming, he decided to quote-unquote silence her forever. But he was sorry about it. Finally, he was convinced that the police weren't going to hurt him, and he handed the phone to Andrea, stopped the car on the side of the road, and at 7:01 a.m. on Tuesday, July 26th, he got out of the car with his hands up and walked backward toward the police officers who had pulled him over. He was put in cuffs, and then Andrea got out of the car and did the same. And I just want to give some kudos to that 911 operator, because what she did was really incredible. She was able to stay really calm, and I truly believe that because of that, she was able to get him to pull over and turn himself in, and then also reassure Andrea that she would be okay. And if that hadn't been the outcome of that situation, things could have been extremely different. So I just thought that was amazing. But after a terrifying crime spree across two states, five of his six victims were thankfully alive to tell the tale. Jack Levy at the time was in the hospital in critical condition, but he would go on to make a full recovery. And now that Edwin was in police custody, their first priority was to find out where Kaylee's body was and exactly what had happened. Edwin's associate degree in criminal justice meant he was familiar with the law, and so detectives expected he would be uncooperative, but they were surprised to find out that he agreed to help them. But even still, he had to be interrogated for 6 full hours.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Detectives did a really good job gaining his trust and stroking his ego enough to get him to tell them where Kaylee's body was before they discussed anything else. He even drew them a map to where to find her. So immediately, police sped to that location. And 2 days after she went missing, Kaylee Sawyer's body was found beside Highway 126 in Oregon, across the street from a mailbox that read 18700. Edwin had initially claimed that he had accidentally hit Kaylee since he was in a hurry and she was drunk and wearing all black. He claimed that when she fell down, he thought he had killed her, so he got out of his car and saw that she was alive but very drunk. And when she saw him, she started screaming, so he panicked and started screaming at her to shut up. She then passed out, and he put her in the back of the patrol car and drove her to a parking lot. But when she woke up, she started screaming again, and he panicked, so he put her in a chokehold, and she was still struggling to scream, so he threw her to the ground and hit her in the head with a rock, and then dragged her body behind a tree and hit her in the head with another rock. He also told them that he had sexually assaulted Kaylee because she was already dead. Now that's horrifying, and that was his initial story of what had happened, but a few of those details do not make a ton of sense. After some time of police prodding him for more details and questioning his clearly shady story, he changed what had happened and told them that he had mistaken Kaylee for a sex worker and had intentionally picked her up and put her in the back seat. He then confirmed that this version of the story meant that he had never accidentally hit her with his car. But the fact that he was a security officer on a college campus meant that he would be no stranger to seeing drunk students walking around at night, so his story of mistaking her for a sex worker did not make any sense either. So they called him out on his lies and told him that they knew that he knew he was going to kill her from the moment he saw Kaylee. They then continued to use his religious beliefs as a tactic, saying that God still loved him and would forgive him, and he wasn't a bad person, but he had done some terrible things. And finally, he began talking about his urges to kill. He then told him he struggled with these urges his whole life, but what had helped him was marrying his wife, because he had something to look forward to. He even told them that he had planned to kill an ex-girlfriend's uncle, but never followed through. And at some point, he mentioned his cousin Vin, who is very possibly the cousin that went to see the movie with him and his wife the day after Kaylee's murder, but he told detectives that Vin had helped him move Kaylee's body. So it wasn't just Edwin who was able to act completely normal and go see a movie and eat pizza with his wife, but also his cousin was able to act completely normal in front of Isabel and go see a movie with his cousin and act as if he didn't just help him move a body. It's insane. The map that Edwin had provided police with did lead them to her body. Her body had been found over some rocks, and because of the way it had been placed, it was initially believed she was alive and was trying to climb up the rocks, but sadly, when they checked her pulse, she was deceased. At the medical examiner's office, it was determined that Kaylee's cause of death was blunt force trauma. There were also signs of strangulation and other injuries. The condition of her body was so horrific that it was deemed unrecognizable by law enforcement, so the police suggested to her family that they don't look at the autopsy photos. And that's just absolutely devastating. And in my opinion, proves that his story of things was absolutely not accurate and was far more severe than he was letting on. In Andrea's car, the one that they had abandoned at the first motel, police had found two notes inside, both with creepy handwriting. One said where he had killed Kaylee, and the other read, "This note is to say I'm sorry for taking her life. To her dad, I'm sorry. To her mom, I'm sorry. She screamed and I had to silence her. My intention was not forever. To my wife, I'm sorry. I will forever love you." Andrea was released from jail shortly after everything and was reunited with her family, who was so grateful to have her back. Because she was in jail for a time. After getting Andrea out of the car with Edwin, they had to take her into custody, and they kind of treated her like a criminal a little bit. They took her fingerprints, her mugshot, they strip-searched her, and they questioned her, and she was in jail for over 12 hours. This poor girl, she had just worked a 12-hour shift, was kidnapped, terrorized, and now she is being treated like a criminal. I do get that things need to be ruled out, but Edwin told them repeatedly that he had kidnapped her, so I really don't think they needed to be that harsh with her, but that was just what happened. Edwin had an arraignment for his charges in California, which included attempted murder, kidnapping, carjacking, and assault with a firearm. However, he was eventually sent back to Oregon to face his murder charges. Since he was facing charges in two states at the same time, things got a little bit complex, and Edwin's attorneys were saying that his six-hour interrogation and confession should be thrown out. And there were a few reasons for that. So Edwin apparently had asked for an attorney when he got to the Tehama County Jail in California, but people working in the jail didn't quite understand what he was asking and that he had been asking for an attorney. They thought that he was asking about the order in which things go. So he didn't get an attorney. And not only that, but in California, there's a law that states when someone is arrested and brought to jail, they have the right to three calls in the first 3 hours, and he was not given those three calls. And so according to his attorneys, this was a violation of his rights. And because of that, the judge did end up ruling that the six-hour interrogation and his confession could not be used in trial. Which was devastating for both law enforcement, who was still working diligently to get this monster behind bars, and Kaylee's family. He had confessed so many times, and they were basically saying, yeah, you can't use that. The death penalty was being sought in Edwin's case, so that evidence was especially crucial. But thankfully, there still was one confessional piece of evidence that could be used. The notes that he had left in Andrea's car, one of which said, quote, "The place I killed her is on the B12 lot," and the other was an apology, like we already talked about. So thankfully, they did still have a confession. And even better than that, Kaylee's family never had to sit through a terrible trial, which would have been extremely traumatizing for them. Having to hear about all of this, and also probably having to see photos that law enforcement had initially told them they absolutely should not look at. So I think that's really great that they didn't have to sit through that. In January of 2018, 18 months after Kaylee's murder, Edwin pled guilty to aggravated murder and robbery and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Multiple loved ones of Kaylee's shared victim impact statements before he was sentenced, and even though they didn't have to sit through a trial, they were pretty upset that he wasn't receiving the death penalty. Kaylee's grandfather said he wished not only that he would receive the death penalty, but that the court would turn Edwin over to him to do it. And honestly, I get it. I get where he's coming from. I can't even comprehend the amount of pain and anger that family would be feeling. And I'm sure he's not the only one that's felt that way in these kinds of situations. Edwin also had some words. He said he didn't have much to say other than a prayer. And then he very dramatically, with his head tilted to the ceiling and his eyes closed, delivered a very over-the-top prayer loudly to the room, which I'm pretty sure Kaylee's family just walked out of the courtroom for, because I'm sorry, you do not get to just apologize and then say a very loud prayer and act like everything's okay. It was also so performative, like it was not genuine, in my opinion. And even if it was, they had every right to walk out of that courtroom. He just murdered one of the most important people in their lives. So I get it. Over the years, more information has come out about exactly what did happen to Kaylee. And it's unclear how Kaylee did end up in the backseat of Edwin's car before he murdered her, but the patrol car was equipped with an enclosed cage in the back, which meant there was no chance she could have escaped. But it is believed that Edwin offered her money for sex, and when she refused, he began insulting her before taking her phone and her purse. Kaylee was screaming, and Edwin was afraid he would be caught, so he choked her until she was unconscious. He then drove her to a remote parking lot on campus called B12, which was a long, windy road. Kaylee woke back up and was trying to fight him, and tried climbing through a little window in the cage divider and was reaching for the car's sirens and lights. Edwin then choked her again, dragged her out of the car, and hit her in the head with the first rock. He then violated her and dragged her behind another tree and hit her with a much larger rock. He then left Kaylee there for dead while he showered and cleaned his car before the end of his shift and even talked to a coworker on his way out. He then went home, got his own car, and went back to get Kaylee's body. He wrapped her bleeding head in a plastic bag before placing her body in his trunk and then bringing her to where she was ultimately found. And after that, he went home, where he acted as if nothing had happened for a full day. That is such a terrifying and heartbreaking situation. And my heart truly goes out to Kaylee Sawyer's family, because that is unbelievably tragic. In 2019, Edwin was sentenced for abducting Andrea, where she gave a victim impact statement and said, quote, "You thought you stole my life from me, but I'm not a victim. I'm a survivor. I'm a warrior. I'm stronger than I've ever been, and you're going to rot where you belong. I'm a survivor. I did conquer you, and I defeated you. I'm moving past this and moving on with my life. My mom raised me to be this beautiful, strong, confident person, and I feel a part of that was taken from me when all of this happened. Now I'm starting to re-find myself and regain that person again." Fuck yeah, Andrea. That is an absolutely incredible victim impact statement. I'm so glad that she is able to move on and is an incredibly strong person and shows that. I think that's really awesome. Edwin's attorneys tried arguing for a 20-year sentence, since that would be the typical time for the crimes he committed, and also blamed what he had done on a diagnosis of myotonic dystrophy, which is a genetic condition that causes muscle weakness and wasting over time. Edwin and his mother had both been diagnosed with it, and people who have this diagnosis sometimes experience fatigue, daytime sleepiness, forgetfulness, confusion, or brain fog. And whether he experienced any of that or not is irrelevant to me, because that would not explain the horror he caused. And the judge didn't think so either, because he was sentenced to a second life sentence, which means he is never getting out of prison. And that is a win, if you ask me. As for Edwin's cousin, Vin, he has never been found, and that's also not his real name, but police are looking for him, and if they ever do find this man and there is enough evidence, they intend on charging him, of course, because Edwin claimed he helped move Kaylee's body. But for now, that is just alleged. So hopefully they're able to get him for that, because that is awful. Isabel, Edwin's wife, filed for divorce only weeks after Kaylee's murder and actually ended up leaving law enforcement completely. And people have criticized her for not going to the police immediately after Edwin left and going 30 minutes later, because they said she could have told them where his parents' house was and had him stopped before he changed cars and went on his days-long crime spree. And I get the anger in a case so intense as this one, but this is absolutely not her fault. She was completely beside herself in the initial interview with police, and she was blindsided by her husband, who dropped an absolute bomb on her And I'm sure she needed a second to like process that. And she did go to the police and turn in her husband. I think 30 minutes is a pretty quick turnaround time. And also, I think that playing the what if game is really dangerous and unhelpful because that isn't what happened. And at this point, you're just kind of throwing blame on a completely innocent woman who did the right thing. So that really shocked me to hear that this woman was having blame placed on her for her terrible husband's evil actions. He is the problem. He is to blame. After Kaylee's death, her family filed a lawsuit against the community college, claiming that other employees were aware of Edwin's fascination with dead people. Once he had lied and told coworkers that he had been a police officer in Honduras and that he had seen bodies all chopped up, and as we talked about earlier, that he had shown sexually explicit pictures and videos to them. And so this lawsuit was settled, with the community college paying Kaylee's family $2 million. Part of that settlement was planned to go toward a book club that Kaylee's mother started called KK's Readers in honor of Kaylee. The program provides books and specifically Kaylee's favorite book, Oh, the Places You'll Go, to early education programs. And Julie has said that the settlement and the book club has brought her daughter back to her, and she's now able to properly grieve Kaylee. And in 2019, they worked to get Kaylee's law signed into law. It's all about getting campus police and security in line and making them more accountable and trustworthy so that communities and campuses are safer. And despite the horrors that her family had to endure, Kaylee's family continues to move forward and honor her memory, which I think is beautiful. In 2018, Andrea posted a picture of her side by side with two officers who worked on the case. And with that, she posted her story on Facebook and thanked everyone for their support. And that's about all I have for where she is today. And I think that's totally fine. She deserves peace and quiet and a really happy future. We wish her nothing but the best, of course. It's just terrifying when people who are supposed to be the ones to keep us safe end up being the monsters. It's entirely possible that while Kaylee was walking drunk down the street, this security car pulled up to her and she had to get in the back because she thought she was in trouble for being drunk or something. Like, we don't know exactly what will happen, and I don't think we'll ever know. But it's just so scary to think about the fact that even if she thought she was in trouble, she thought that she was safe. And then she's put in this situation that is horrifying and evil and ultimately took her life. And my heart also really goes out to Cameron, because I'm sure he had to have felt some kind of guilt after this whole situation and feel like it was his fault for not going after her and whatever. But again, this was something she would do all the time, and it's nobody's fault other than Edwin's. So I also hope he's out there living his life and is able to move forward from this, because he deserves peace as well. I'm also so glad that nothing happened to that family that Edwin kidnapped, and also that Jack Levy survived his gunshot wound, because he was shot in the abdomen in a motel room. He's very lucky that he was able to get help quick enough and he survived. So, you know, I just hope he gets back to taking pictures of his butterflies, because he should not have been wrapped up in this whole situation. Nobody should have. But anyway, I think that's all I have to say about that. Why don't we move on to something a little bit lighter, and I'll leave you with a bit of a palate cleanser and tell you something good. My good thing is that I made myself a really good cup of tea. Sometimes it's that simple. I made a really nice cup of chai tea, and I had it in my little gingerbread mug that I mentioned earlier in the beginning of the episode. And also, over the next couple of days, I'm going to be taking out all my Christmas decorations, and I'm putting them up. It's time. I'm doing it. I'm not going to listen to Christmas music yet, because that is special, and I have to hold off on that. Because also, you know these songs, you've heard them a million times. It's really only reserved for, like, December. So I can at least respect that. But I have an ornament collection, and it deserves its time in the sun. And I think that time is now. So that's what I'm going to be doing over the next couple days. And I'm sure I'll post about it on our close friends list that you can access at patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. Okay. Anyways, thank you guys so much for listening. If you have a story of your own that you would like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. I post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. We have new merch. You can find the link to that in our Instagram bio as well. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T on the podcast is a 3, because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.